Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and I'm a vice president for Chapter 92, Daniel Ellsberg Chapter 92 in Seattle. And this is the Veterans for Peace radio show, broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. And with me today are Eric Martin and Curtis Layton. They're both teachers. Eric recently returned from the Holy Land, if you may call it that, Palestine and Israel. And one of the things I'm talking about war is the just war theory. And I was wondering if you can sort of fill me in or give an explanation of how what is happening in the Middle East, in particular Israel and Gaza, how that fits into any sort of definition of just war.
Sure. First, thanks for having me.
Sure, thank
And
you.
yeah, just maybe a word about what the trip is first, and then I can get to how it fits into just war theory. So there was an interfaith peace delegation or ceasefire delegation that went, and I'm a Catholic, so I was invited as a representative of the Catholic world. And we went for about 2 weeks to meet with people on the ground. We were mostly in the West Bank. And part of our stay there functioned as a way of keeping people safe from settler violence in the West Bank, and also to hear their stories and be able to pass them back to people in the United States. And so when you ask about just war theory, what's happening there, you kind of have this dual way of looking at it. One way, it was very clear being there, you could look at it as an abuse of just war theory. The idea that under certain circumstances, when the cause is just, it's permissible to use violence. With given certain restrictions, it's got to be proportional to the threat being faced. Even if we just took that one criterion, proportionality, the violence being done upon Palestinians is way out of proportion with whatever the stated threat is from the government of Israel. We watched smoke rising from the Gaza border, people being bombed. People call it, an open air prison, but also in the West Bank. The violence is pretty horrific. People's homes are being destroyed by the government. People are being driven from their homes by settlers in the West Bank. And so what you have is this, you can see what's happening in Palestine, this exploitation of the ability to abuse the language, right? That this is a just cause. This is a just war. What's happening there is completely unjust. And on the flip side, just war theory affirms, right, the right for people to, under certain circumstances, use proportional violence to secure their freedom from oppressors. And so, what I saw, if one buys into the just war theory, is there is a justification under just war theory for Palestinians to fight back and use counterviolence against the nation state that's oppressing them. And by and large, the people we saw, we weren't meeting with Hamas, we're meeting with people on the ground, they were overwhelmingly using the rhetoric of nonviolence and saying we're nonviolent. So they were refusing to pick up the just war theory and saying we decline that rationale and we affirm the necessity of loving our neighbor, even if they're bombing us, and trying to put that into practice. So it was a stark difference in how just war theory can be applied, how it is being applied, and also how it can be set aside and neglected because
Yeah.
some people say there's a better way.
So the Palestinians that you talked to were actually said that they were in proposing nonviolent solutions. And which was this people the people in Gaza? Does not be this is in the West Bank, not Gaza.
Right, well, we're not allowed in Gaza. We got to the border, but that's. So, yes, one example would be this community called the Tent of Nations. It's a Christian community in Palestine, and it's the last remaining hilltop that's owned by Palestinians in the surrounding area. It's completely surrounded by illegal settlements of people building up around them, and they're actively trying to drive them off this land, this hilltop, the Tent of Nations. And since 1991, they've had to fundraise $250,000 to pay for the court fees to try and establish the fact that they've lived there since the Ottoman Empire without ceasing. And Yeah, we sat down with the family there and they said, yeah, we want to resist, but we want to do it legally and non-violently. We're Christians. We believe in loving our enemy. And, A, it would be useless to use violence. We're working against a military and people that are enabled by a military. That's just not going to work. But more importantly, just it's not a part of our spirituality and philosophy approach to life.
Well, you may not be able to answer this, but for a not biblical, but say from a rabbinical point of view, what is the justification for what has happened so far? I mean, there must be some sort of a establishment Jewish religious justification for their disproportionate, as you mentioned, response to the original Hamas attack.
Sure, it's a really good question. It's helpful because it helps distinguish between Judaism, if we could call it like, so talk about it as a religion, and the distinction between that and Israel as a nation state. And they get conflated a lot, such that if the nation state of Israel says something, people assume that Judaism, it represents Judaism, which it does not. Many Jews will be the first to say, yeah, that nation state doesn't represent our 2,000-year-old religion. That's only been around since 1948. And so, but yeah, so the nation state of Israel gives a justification. So if you took it at face value, it would say roughly, Hamas attacked us on October 7th, and we have a right to secure our safety by going in and eliminating the people who are responsible for that attack because they could attack us again. So in that sense, it's retributive violence, but also a bit of a preemptive strike against a possible next strike that Hamas might be planning. So that would be the rhetoric. The reality, again, it's not proportional, the violence, and it's not the violence is not being absorbed mostly by Hamas. It's, I mean, you can read the news coming out day in and day out. They're killing families, killing people that have nothing to do with Hamas. People who, many of whom would say Hamas doesn't represent me. I don't agree with Hamas's tactics. I don't see them as legitimate, but they're being killed nonetheless. So it's helpful to distinguish A between the nation state of Israel and the religion of Judaism, and between who's responsible for what happened on October 7th and who's bearing the brunt of the response to it from Israel. And then a third, shorter way to respond to that is distinguishing between a government's stated justification, because as the journalist I.F. Stone said, governments lie. And then looking at the real historical background, going back to 1948 or 1917 or even 1898, the attack on October 7th was obviously horrific, but it also fits in a broader history that doesn't justify it, but helps explain why it happened, how it happened. And it's hard to talk about the history there as if it started on October 7th. And that's something that just war theory. Oh, go ahead.
No, boy. Yeah, that's great. That's thank you for that background. As sort of a background to for me, I came to my activism in the Veterans for Peace directly as a result of my experience with war, and that war was Vietnam. And what I saw there was not so much I was not a infantryman, but I was an interrogator linguist, and my experience mostly was that that was life changing was the witnessing of our village next to us completely obliterated, and the people who were maybe of which we knew these people because they were our neighbors, and perhaps 200 people were killed. I actually have sent I've got a piece that I'll send to you if you haven't, on called May Girl, and it's a chapter describing what that was. But the short long and short of that was that there was a destruction, an uncalled for destruction of this village, and where at least the 200 civilians were killed, to the extent that they were removing the bodies with dump trucks. So that's my background, and that's why I came to Veterans for Peace, and also of the opinion that, not an original opinion, that war is usually there's really no such thing as just war, in the sense that regulations that have been around for a few centuries and the sentiments for doing something about war and curtailing or controlling it, how it's conducted, have never been followed. And the attempts to control combatants are feeble and almost useless. So, given that history, it's difficult to say that, war of any kind, even just war, is really justified. Although, self-defense is one thing, and but a war in the sense that it's an organized military slaughter often is something else. So,
Mike, I think you have an ally in Pope Francis. He said very much the same thing, that war is always a failure, and has really called for a reevaluation of, what's come down to be called just war. And you ask sort of about the establishments, whether it's the rabbinical or the Catholic Church. And I think, Eric pointed this out, but I think like internal diversity within religious traditions is something to be acknowledged. And if even the Pope can kind of question, what, I mean, I know the church, can look monolithic, but I mean, even the Pope is sort of disagreeing with that. And I think, I'm no expert in just war theory, and I feel like the nonviolent resistance, as far as I know, is always to be preferred to to violent means. I think Eric's trip for as a as kind of a peacekeeper, as a witness, is an example of that, that there we sometimes lack the imagination to see what, what other than the, and I've never been to war. I've never had my homeland threatened, so of course I can't tell anyone what kind of resistance is appropriate. But I think like just that notion that there is such a thing as a just war is even kind of a I don't think even a just war expert would put it that flatly, that like there is such a thing that is a morally just war, like that it's always going to be a mix, that it's always going to be that there's always going to be some evil. I think that's what Pope Francis is saying, is that it's always in some sense a moral failure when there is violence, even in like a war that we look at now is like the conflict in Ukraine, which I think many people are more likely to kind of consider a quote unquote good war. That too like involves so much gray area and so much moral failure and loss of life and loss of fields and future generations.
Well, absolutely. Thank you for that. The other thing is that most wars actually could be prevented, and the way to prevent that is dialogue and discussion. And as far as war goes, or using nonviolence, I mean, there is some of that in the West Bank, in particular, some of the Palestinians that, and some of the people who are involved in the protest here in the States, but also, I mean, the example that comes to me is Gandhi and his opposition to the Indian state, and he and his followers preferred to be beaten, and they were beaten and savagely beaten, but in the end they got, there was a resolution to the conflict in India, and had they taken up arms, it would not have happened. I don't think so. I mean, that's not an original thought. I think that that's kind of a given. The other thing is that war, one of the things is a talking point, if you want to call that, or part of the philosophy of war, is that anybody who's involved in war in just about any way is can be claim moral injury. And not only that, but I mean the VA, in considering PTSD, for example, will allow moral injury, and that is people who are not necessarily combat related, but were in the war and were wearing a uniform, and they have moral injury and psychological sort of issues with being part of the military, part of a society that supports war or paid for the war, or actually were in fact actually soldiers in the war. So it is a it's a concept that I think is actually deserves more sort of exposure, to the extent that if you're working for Boeing, for example, building bombs that are dropping on or missiles that are dropping on Israel, I mean, your moral injury can actually be part of that sort of manufacturing process. You're producing the war. The war machine is your fault. You're not, no one is a bystander. No.
Wow,
The
I didn't, yeah,
go ahead.
no, I didn't know that about the VA, and I feel like I'm amazed that there is just that kind of category. That, of course, to be involved in it, and of course, to be alive in 2024 is to somehow, you know, what it feels like to be complicit in some way in the war machine. Eric, we spoke a little bit yesterday, and you were talking about the people you met in Palestine. I don't want to take your story, but of the fact that there were farmers who were planting, there were people who were speaking about future generations that would survive, and like the hope that you found. I wonder if that feels relevant, because I often feel like, well, we're all so wrapped up in this, like, this moral injury that is being done to us, that we're doing to others, and that there are still people who are can truly claim moral injury, who are hopeful.
Yeah, that was something very striking, and I thought it was a good antidote to what I would call the sometimes paralyzing despair I encounter on college campuses. I teach at UCLA and Loyola Marymount University, and just to be general, a lot of students, I think, there's this kind of a culture of despair, and I think a lot of it is justified among college-age students. But what I don't see as often is what I saw among many of the Palestinians I met, which is, I'm working with a small sample size, but people who had all the reason to fall into despair. And, among the mourning, I don't want to pretend the mourning and the sorrow is not there and the death and destruction, but among it, there is planting and praying and song. And I think it's a good antidote to, yeah, this culture of despair that I see among pockets of American society that have less of a right to despair, but fall into it more. And I think part of this, I mean, I come from a nonviolent tradition myself. I studied Dan Bergen, and I'm part of the Catholic Left and the Catholic Worker Movement, and Dorothy Day was pacifist even during World War II when it was very unpopular. And so I'm pretty committed to nonviolence, but I think that people who are committed to nonviolence, who are not part of an oppressed community, so not talking about the civil rights movement or Gandhi's salt marches or anything like that, I think we need to grapple with something that, like, the why is there a just war theory? There's a bad reason, right? A way of justifying empire and terrible war. But there's also a kernel of something in it that, it's pretty understandable. And so I'm thinking of these letters between Dan Berrigan, who was this poet and priest and peacemaker back in the 60s. That was probably when it was most famous, end of the 60s, early 70s. He wrote letters to Ernesto Cardenal, who was a Sandinista, a fellow priest, and a revolutionary fighting against a dictatorship in Nicaragua, part of this larger political movement. And one of their tactics was guerrilla fighting, picking up arms and fighting against the government dictatorship. their cause was just. It was to be free of an American-funded brutal dictatorship, to be able to vote, have freedom of all the freedoms that are we take for granted here. And so they wrote letters, and Dan said, you know, you can't be part of a group that's picking up guns. You can't hold the gun and a gospel. You've got to be nonviolent. And Ernesto Cardenal rejected that and said, yeah, I believe that. Dan Berrigan told him, there's no principle that's worth the death of a person, right? You can't kill people for good principles. And Cardenal said, yeah, I agree. That's why I'm with the Sandinistas. So they were operating among similar principles, but what I think Cardenal was bringing to light is from the point of view of a legitimately oppressed people, say, unlike the IDF right now, who are occupiers in a land not their own. For the Sandinistas, to have someone not from their country, not facing their own risks, preach nonviolence at them is actually a way of kind of outsourcing all the violence that's going to be absorbed onto an already oppressed people. And so I think it's the responsibility of people who are preaching nonviolence to enflesh it rather than try and use the rhetoric of nonviolence to police people who are facing serious threats. And so I think that's one danger of the rhetoric of nonviolence, even though I am myself committed to nonviolence and I like it, I think it can be used in ways that are not nonviolent and can, in a sense, make violence more predictable, and just that they wouldn't bear it. Other poorer people or oppressed people would bear it. Yeah, I think that's always helpful to highlight when we talk about just war theory.
Well, see, I was going to say is that, well, everyone who's, whether it's they consider it a just war or not, everyone who's part of a war, and particularly somebody directly involved in it, more directly involved in it, comes away with a well, not only moral injury, but actually there no one escapes the toxic legacy of the war. If you're close to it or see it, you're gonna live with that the rest of your life, no matter how justified you think it is or how righteous you are. And Cardenal and these people who fought against as a Sandinista, those fighters know that too. There's no such thing as you can't escape this sort of a toxicity of the war, whether you were justified. You know, the other thing is that Cardinal is how I don't know if it's been examined very well, probably not them, but by Cardinal, but how useful a non-violent opposition to the regime would have been. Probably much more difficult, but you know, it's a possibility that might have happened.
Can I actually just one last detail, since you bring that up, like to look at the Nazis, say like the what we accept as the most evil example of human society in the modern era. Gandhi, whose principles I think are great, he recommended that the Jews be nonviolent. And so just think of how beautiful an example and witness it would be to the world to have Jews willingly go to slaughter as a way of showing the evil of the Nazis. And you know, your people will be redeemed in the process. It won't be wasted lives. And Martin Buber, who is a famous Jewish philosopher, wrote back, it's just basically saying, yay, that might work great with the British Empire. That's not going to work with us. And it's not right for you to tell us that we need to be nonviolent when Hitler's committing a Holocaust against us. And, you know, it was not, he wasn't saying butt out, but it was a charitable engagement of saying, you don't really know what you're talking about. Your principles work where you are. That's great. Don't try and tell us that we have to go face the tanks and the gas chambers willingly, in the spirit of charity and love. And I think I teach a class called Religious Fascisms and Anti-Fascisms at UCLA, and my students are, you know, they become very attached to Gandhi's principles, and then we read that letter and they're like, oh well, yeah, that's true also. And so whether or not we think it's true, I think it's good to hold these two things in tension when we think about it. I think it helps clarify what nonviolence means and who should be enfleshing it first and who we should point the finger to when it's time to be nonviolent.
Well, you know, that's an interesting remark that you made about that the Jews should have gone willingly. You know, and one of the psychological sort of detritus of the Holocaust is that some people say, well, they went like lambs to the slaughter anyway. They didn't resist, and as Israel, we will resist. And I think that sort of thinking has got led some of the elements of the Jewish state to be a lot more aggressive and violent, not just in defense of the thing, but you strike us, we're going to strike you twice as hard. And there's a lot of sort of biblical sort of rhetoric in that too. But and the other thing, you know, getting back to what you said about students being apathy, I thought I was, as somebody who's been an activist for quite a while, I found it very heartening to see, at least in this country, actually in Europe too, the amount of people, the Jewish or students that were in opposition to Gaza and what was happening there, very heartening. And they were the ones that put their that actually put their careers in some cases, their educational and their some give jail time for some of them, but they were the only element of society really in this country that was in direct opposition to what is happening in Gaza. And I think that we owe a big debt of gratitude for that example, really. I certainly feel that way. You know, it's in the finest tradition of student activism, really. And if I know you can tell that or mention that to your students, if they're apathetic, says they did a wonderful thing. I mean, everything. And it wasn't just sort of average. There were a lot of Jewish students who were in opposition to this and put themselves out there. So, I mean, there's that.
Yeah, I'll go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Kurt, Eric.
Oh, I was just going to agree with you. I teach at UCLA, so it was one of the prime examples that people focused on the encampment there, and a lot of my students were involved. And yeah, it was really heartening to see. When I mentioned earlier, like some people fall into a paralyzing despair, it was heartening to see how many people did not do that. And as you say, it's important to note that a lot of Jewish students were out there. Because that's a good counterpoint to the sort of manufactured myth that Jewish students were not allowed in there, or Jewish students were not allowed to walk freely on campus. There were plenty of Jewish students in the encampment. It was just people who presented a threat to the encampment who were not given entry. And anybody could walk anywhere. It was just a plot of grass you
Yeah.
could walk around. So that's helpful for you to point that out. Thank you.
So, or to the also an antidote to the Israeli standard proposed that says any criticism of the state of Israel is anti-Semitic. I mean that's their knee-jerk response of the state of Israel to any criticism. You're anti-Semitic.
Right, which it should be said, when bodies of scholars get together to define anti-Semitism, a consistent aspect of that definition is conflating Israel with Judaism, because that is something anti-Semites do. And so, in those conflations, which are purposeful and cynically applied, right, by people who want to justify the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, that is actually anti-Semitic by definition. To say that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that is conflating Judaism with Israel, which is, according to the scholars studying this, anti-Semitic itself. So it's kind of spreading one of among many forms of anti-Semitism to say that.
Although I probably have to say that that is not widely understood, even in the press, that definition. And we're to say that if you're an anti-Zionist, you're an anti-Semitic. And Zionism has got a lot of problems with it as in its various manifestations. Certainly, the Zionism of what they got today, at least the what they call Zionism, is not. Maybe what Chaim Herzog was talking about, or the original kibbutz settlers, you know, in their vegetarian farmers living and trying to live in peace with their Arab neighbors, come a long way since that. So.
Definitely. And I think you're highlighting this, like the lack of clarity on what is anti-Semitism? What does Zionism even mean? Because many people did mean many different things by it. I think this lack of clarity can be chalked up to many things, but one is a poor media system that fails to inform us on key information. And when we talk about issues of war, like we're doing, what is it that enables war? One is a poorly informed populace, because a poorly informed population is easily manipulated. And so I think it's good. I'm just, I suppose, saying I'm glad you bring this up, because when issues of war and peace, the media is a key player in manufacturing war, or to be used as an instrument for peacemaking. And I think that lack of clarity is partly their fault, and it enables a lot of the violence we see that's being, as you pointed out earlier, funded by the United States, being absorbed by Gazans and people in the West Bank right now.
And of course, you know, as far as that sort of the overall picture is concerned, the probably the best propagandists in modern time are the Israelis, and they learned that from the Brits. You know, they learn how to do that from the British and their occupation of the Holy Land, and turning eventually and end up getting kicked out of there by activist Jewish people were shooting is British troops, but they're very good at it. And the Israeli media is basically part of that sort of these days anyway. If you go to look at the Jerusalem Post or anything, any of the other Jewish or newspapers, national newspapers, they have drifted considerably to the right since the Intifada, but since this recent struggle. So
I wonder if we could go back to the culture of despair thing, because I certainly feel that that's something that I have fallen into at times. And Mike, you mentioned, the biblical justifications of for retributive violence, and but I also think some, part of the Jewish scriptures is this whole tradition of lament and of giving voice to collective grief and mourning and crying out to God for justice. And I often feel like that's one thing, maybe at a different time in religious history, justifying war was something that religions could be used for. I feel like when I think about my own religious faith, it does provide me a way of feeling like I can grieve, can voice my confusion, my shame, all of that in a collective form. I think that's something we've really lost. And when I encounter that kind of culture of despair in students and in myself, I feel like we've kind of lost that. I guess that's something that I've become more aware of, especially when I mean, others have spoken about our inability to kind of grieve for what we've done to the earth, and when it comes to our planet, that we often fall prey to that culture of despair because we have no way of kind of grieving all that we've done and all that we've lost. And I don't know. I wonder. I don't. I think the church today is has no idea. I mean, none of us, I think, have really any idea of how to provide that space for collective grief. But I do think the biblical scriptures, especially the Psalms, the collective laments are a way that we could rediscover a form of like dealing with some of that moral injury instead of just numbing ourselves to it. I don't know if any Eric, I don't know if you have or Mike, I don't know like to what extent our religious leaders are doing that, but I do think that that's kind of where I hear Pope Francis's comments about just war, is that he's not that's not like the register that he's speaking from. I think he's more looking for that how do we grieve? How do we find a space for a kind of a collective lament?
Or to, you know, fall back on some of the, well, perhaps you'd call them cliches from Christ's own teaching, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, which is actually not Christ, but that that's Old Testament, or correct me if I'm wrong. It's not necessarily Christ saying that, but, you know, swords into plowshares, that sort of thing. There's a lot of good examples that from Christ and also some of the other biblical pronunciations that are unfortunately not very well, we put into sort of public action.
Yeah. I think Blessed are the Peacemakers is from the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew,
okay,
I believe. But yeah, to I mean, Curtis, yeah, this idea of healing, how do we heal? You didn't use that word, but I hear that in the background of everything you're saying. And to use kind of a micro example, I lived in Charlottesville in 2017 when the Unite the Right happened. And for the background for your listeners, you know, the largest white supremacists gathering, at least overtly white supremacist gathering in modern American history. Extreme violence. They attacked people with poles, especially Black people. They murdered Heather Heyer with a car. And so healing was needed. And how do we make ritualized space for this inability to grapple with what happened that you're mentioning, Curtis? And Rabbi Mordecai Liebling was with the clergy group that day, which I was also with. And even in the middle of the day, you know, he knew, like, we need to pull back and have some space to heal ourselves. Like, we know there's more to be done today, but we need to begin the healing now. And just kind of ducked into an alley and circled us up and gave us space. And yeah, held this ritualized space. And I think what you're talking about, religion can play that role. And for people who aren't religious, I see people creating these ritualized ways of doing it. For example, Reverend Smash the Patriarchy, Brittany King Conley, who was more or less kind of the chaplain of the town when that happened. I believe the day after all that violence, the town came together in the murder site where Heather Heyer was murdered. And even though she's a Christian reverend in the UCC, held a ritualized space where people didn't have to engage in Christian worship to enter, but everybody was welcomed. And it was a moving display of exactly what you're talking about. Like, what just happened? We don't know how to make sense of it. We don't know how to stop it from happening again. But something we can do is just come together communally and hold each other. And yeah, I think that is something religion can bring to the table. And coming from the Christian tradition, yeah, there's a lot to draw on in the scriptures that I agree.
Well, Dorothy Day and also the Catholic Worker, one of their ways of dealing with that sort of things like that is activism, and activism in the sense of writing speeches on the streets. You know, they were very active in that sense. And I think that that is a way to deal with it. In a sort of like a similar sort of thing, I got some therapy at the Veterans Administration for PTSD. And one of the groups that I was in was a Veterans Administration group that were using handouts from Thich Nhat Hanh on mindfulness and, you know, mindfulness walking, mindfulness generally, you know, breathing exercise, that sort of thing. And here he is, this is a Veterans Administration official sort of thing. And he was a pacifist Buddhist Vietnamese monk. And the idea that an American institution dealing with American veterans is using that kind of example is really, it was kind of mind-boggling at the time, not so much now. But the other thing I want to mention in talking about activism is that, and particularly you being in the West Bank, is Rachel Corrie, who went there to defend the Palestinians against the Israeli brutality as best she could, and end up getting killed for it. In fact, one of our chapters in the South Sound is the Rachel Corrie chapter. I don't know if you knew that, but locally we've got some famous chapters anyway, names anyway. I think that Meditation and meditation and center as healing is certainly an underrated way of dealing with stress and also, well, trauma. I think it should be taught more. The idea of meditation is, and I'm not an expert at it all, but that sort of thing that you're talking about, Eric, you can do it, and the more you do it, the better you get at it. I don't know. Maybe you have that sort of after you're teaching one of your classes, need to go into a closet sometime to meditate.
Well, I think it's helpful you bring up Thich Nhat Hanh and mindfulness. I think it's helpful just to know that that way is out there for a lot of people. If the only options available to you are limited to, like, if we're talking about war, right? To either participating in the war or not participating but not resisting, then that enables the war. But once you realize there are other ways out there, and since you bring out Dorothy Day, it's a good example. She kind of showed a way to people that they didn't really know existed. In 1955, New York City was doing air raid drills, which they would ring the sirens and people would practice what to do if there was a nuclear bomb that was dropped on New York City. So they'd go into the subway, which is kind of insane because they'd all be buried under rubble. But she named it as a form of psychological warfare upon the people of New York City and a way of preparing people psychologically for the potential of nuclear war. So it's almost a training ground for finding nuclear war not so much acceptable as inevitable, and that enables warfare. So she just said, "I'm going to City Hall and I'm going to picket. I'm going to hold signs with quotes from popes." And the first year was just a couple of people, and it grew and grew. And I believe it took from 55 to 1961. There were hundreds of people that went outside City Hall, and they got it shut down. And I think people just need to see that. Oh, this is an interesting way. That's another option. And I didn't know somebody was enfleshing this way. And now that I know it, I have more options when it comes to war. And it turns out this way is appealing to me. And I don't ha it's not a, there's a cost. People are getting arrested. But once there's enough people, you're create you're becoming part of a community, and you're getting to exercise your conscience and learning a different way to walk in the world than the ones that are provided you by whatever mainstream media or the econ classes have told you about.
Well, one of the way, in
I,
fact, go ahead, Curtis.
oh no, I just wanted to, I didn't know that about Dorothy Day, and I just came from I teach in secondary schools, and so active shooter drills are just part of life in schools in America, and it's always I've always felt like it's one of those things that it does such a psychic kind of it does something that the whole rest of the day it's a little off because students are thinking about what if there was a shooter, what would I do? And I've always wondered, is there a way to bring some kind of mindfulness practice or something? And anyway, it makes me think of that and that idea of kind of the moral injury that we live with, just as citizens in a country with the kind of gun violence that we have. That was it.
Yeah, just get your Dorothy down, Curtis.
Well, I'd have to say it's not original again on my part is that the trauma that this country has experienced from gun violence is directly attributed to the fact that there aren't so many guns in this country. Most of the gun violence with guns is done through suicide, and if you try and kill yourself with a gun, it's you're usually successful. Most of the deaths are gun deaths are from suicide in this country, and you can't have a country that is armed like us and not have sort of a. I mean, the guns are widely available for anybody who wants to use them for whatever purpose they want to. And they're very much a glorified sort of thing. And how you change that culture, I'm not exactly sure exact how, but having so, too many weapons. I mean, we could just go back to something as simple as banning assault weapons, which is one part of the thing, which was banned for a number of years in the past. So yeah, the that is a trauma. You know, I mentioned talking about Bertha Day. She would be right involved with Golden Rule. And the Golden Rule, if you don't know, Eric and Curtis, you may not know too either. It's actually a peace boat that went to attempted to go to the South Pacific during the just in the 50s to protest the atomic tests down there. The boat and its inhabitants were arrested, taken back to Hawaii. The boat ended up actually in California, in Sunk and Humboldt Bay. And the Veterans for Peace chapter there and others picked that boat up and put it in a boatyard and rebuilt it. And now the Golden Rule sails up and down the West Coast, working for an anti-nuclear world. It's been to Seattle several times, and Long Beach, L.A., Canada, and actually we put it on a truck and brought it over to the East Coast, and we went up and down the East Coast with this boat. But what that boat signifies is the opposition to nuclear weapons, and it's a visible sort of thing, and it's always well received. So that the issue isn't going away, it's not hidden. We actually went up to the hung around outside of Bangor, which has got the Trident submarines, which is like a, basically the largest nuclear deterrence and web collection of weapons in the world. One of those subs has got more firepower on it than, you know, 100 Hiroshimas. So, and the other thing you're talking about, you know, public sort of activism, you may be aware of this, Eric, but and Curtis too, is that every year in Green Lake, they have the Hiroshima Nagasaki celebration, and they put cranes on the send cranes, lead cranes out on the water. They're people speeches and sort of music and that sort of thing. Veterans for Peace is there, of course, but it's a public example of opposition and sort of putting the issue right in front of people's faces, really. So there's you know, Eric, we'll see you next year at
I'll be there.
your
Yeah, send me the
third
invite.
Curtis.
Yeah,
You live actually in LA and L in LA or San Diego.
LA.
Yeah. So well, Curtis, what is it like to teach high schoolers? And does these issues come up at all? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. They do come up. I was telling Eric that I, you know, I mentioned we sometimes will begin our class with a prayer, and I'll ask if anybody has intentions, and sometimes I'll volunteer intentions of my own. And I told Eric that I had said his name and the name of the group that was going to the West Bank in Palestine, and I had a student just ask, why would you do that? Why would you put yourself in harm's way in that way? And I think there's like a real wondering. I mean, I teach Spanish and I've been a religion teacher, and I think there's a real hunger for student, you know, among students to know how can we participate in this? You know, I work at a school that's students have a corporate work study job. They go to work one day a week. They go to school 4 days a week. It's a Cristo Rey school. There's about 40 of them nationwide, and so they have all this experience of like kind of imagining what life as a as an adult might look like, and they put on a tie when they go to work, and they learn how to shake hands and kind of how to make your way in the world and in a corporate environment. But I think at the same time they're kind of wondering like, what does it look like to participate in society? And it, like I think, you know, that kind of idea of how do you enlarge the imagination of someone who may not think to, or, you know, teachers included, who might not think like, there's another way besides simply participating or refusing to participate in active shooter drill, for example, like that there might be other alternatives or like forms of activism that they've never thought about. So I mean, I think Catholic schools, I would hope, Jesuit schools maybe are those places where the imagination can be involved in like imagining the world. I mean, in some ways, participating in the world as it is and also imagining a world that is different sounds very lofty. And I think, you know, to Eric's point, in fleshing it every day is a bigger challenge, but one that I think students are really, really hungry for. I don't always feel like I'm able to meet that moment. Sometimes it's just here's our content for the day. But I'm always grateful for those questions, wonderings about like how do you really participate in this world? Because they see you know, the contradictions, they see the injustices. So yeah, it's something that I wonder about.
Well, we might have to let it go at that, the wonder,
Yeah.
because we're about well, no, another 5 minutes or so. You know, actually, I think that that's an important thing. If you talk to students or I mean, I go into schools and talk to like career fairs and talk to kids about the military and says, do you know enough to join the military? What is the military? What is militarism? What do you think you're going to be doing in the military? What's it like to pick up a gun and put a uniform on? Ask questions like that. We're not telling them something. If they want to ask me a question about what I know, I'll be glad to tell them. But the it's not an but asking questions to as part of education is a really good way to discussion, you know, facilitate discussion. I don't think you can. I mean, that's one way to talk about, you know, corporate responsibility and war. As far as what they're going to do with their life, you know, there's some maybe some hard truths about corporations and what they do that I don't know if high school students are willing to look at that or want to look at it, or maybe it's not your job to do that. But it's, I mean. It's not, you know, an opinion of me, but I mean, corporations are essentially criminal organizations, in my opinion.
Well, you'll have
Not all, but
to,
most.
yeah. Maybe if you'll invite me back in 4 years' time, this is it's a brand new school, and we're 8 weeks into it. And I wonder if you know, when these students that I'm teaching now are about ready to graduate, you know, what that journey will have been like for them, and maybe they will have some more questions about these corporations that they're working with.
Well, I'd be glad to come to your school and
Yeah, well,
maybe pose those questions. I don't know if I got that many answers, but if you know, actually, for one of the state of Washington and probably other states too, have got this thing for Veterans Day and a policy, statewide policy in this state anyway, that they want veterans to come and speak in the schools. I had one such opportunity recently, and I said, you know, this is what we do. I gave them a pamphlets which shows our talking points for Veterans for Peace, and it was a little bit too much for him. This is a public school, and he says, "Well, I don't know if a, you know," he begged off, and I, which really irritated me, quite frankly. I said, "I'll send this to you, this May girl," and I said, "They should all read this essay of me." I said, "I mean, I'm not the only one that wrote this, writes this sort of thing, but if they're going to look at the world and their part in it, they should probably look at it with open eyes. Better than not, you know." I mean, I was a history student before I got drafted, and I was an older guy by the time I was 21, but still, I didn't really have any idea what I was getting into. And I don't think students have much of an idea too. I mean, too bad more people couldn't in go with you, Eric, and see what's really happening on the ground. It's an eye-opener. Did you actually, would you bring that experience back and sort of synopsis to your students in class?
Oh yes, and I have. I was about to say something I offered to the students. I gave a talk on my campus about it, and 36 students signed up as interested in doing the same thing because Sabeel is the center that runs it, and they would like to do more of these delegations. And so, if any of your listeners are interested, just look up Sabeel, Sabeel. It's the Palestinian Liberation Theology Center. They are inviting people to come and see the situation on the ground.
Well, one of the things that we do, Veterans for Peace, is support an organization called Peace Trees Vietnam, which is the only American NGO that's actually involved in demining situations in Vietnam, and is partially supported by the United States government. Not very well supported, but supported nonetheless. One of the things they do is and also for Veterans for Peace in Vietnam veterans, what they go is go out there and we build schools and community centers. You can go back there and work on those sort of things, which is an active participation to do something, concrete, if you will. For as far as where you are concerned, there's probably not that much of an opportunity to do that in Palestine or the West Bank, but
They
perhaps.
could use it because they do have landmines. We passed fields with signs saying "Danger, do not enter landmines" in the West Bank. But no, yeah, I don't know if the IDF would let you go defuse them right now.
Okay, well, thank you, Eric Martin and Curtis Layton, for being on the radio show, VFP92.org, and it's broadcast on KODX 96.9. And my name is Mike Diedrich, and this is the Veterans for Peace radio show. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.